Next up on This Week in Law, New Media Rights is in the house with Art Neal and Terry Karabonic. We're going to talk about why you shouldn't put things into the cloud, why you shouldn't believe every court order you receive, Uncarriers, net neutral toilets, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 274, recorded September 5th, 2014. YOLO! This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/twill. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We are so excited to have you with us this week. Lots has been going on. We're going to talk about things that have been shared and things that we will share with you, all at the intersection of technology and law. We're really thrilled to have back this week two folks from newmediarights.org. Art Neal is joining us again. Hello, Art.
Hi, Denise. Great to be here. Thanks for having us back.
Wonderful to have you back. And also Art's colleague, Terry Karabonic, is here. Hello, Terry.
Hi, Denise. Thanks again for having us back.
My pleasure. I didn't just butcher your name, did I?
No, you actually got it right, which is
pretty
rare.
I'm so glad. I didn't even check beforehand. Did what that one on the fly. So excited that I remembered. Also here is Evan Brown, my co-host. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. How you doing today?
Doing great. It's looking sunny there in Chicago.
It is. You know, I mean, it's the end of September, or what is it? No, it's the beginning of September, right? End of summer is what I meant to say. So, yeah, still plenty of the sunshine and the good season to live in Chicago. Still plenty of that left for at least a little while longer. So, yeah, it's a good day. But like usual, always the best place to be right now is here talking about the law and technology. So I'm happy about it.
I know, me too. All right, let's get into it. Let's talk about a big story this week on the privacy front. So even if you don't store things in iCloud, you have probably heard about the fate of some who did, may perhaps still do. The celebrity photos that leaked out over the, at least news of them leaked out over the holiday weekend last weekend. And folks were very unhappy to find that photos that they thought they had stored in the cloud in a private manner had actually been hacked in a targeted way and released. These were mostly celebrity photos. Lots of folks in states of undress, as Evan and I were discussing before the show. I'm afraid maybe some of our audience is more knowledgeable about exactly what was in these photos than either of us are, because we've not seen them. We don't know if they were selfies or perhaps professionally taken kind of glamour shots. We do know that they were meant to be private. They were not meant to be shared, and yet they were, and folks are up in arms and not happy with Apple. So obviously, I think the network here has covered the security aspects of this probably ad nauseum this week. So we're going to focus a bit on the legal side. Evan, do you think under these circumstances, companies are going to have to start rethinking not just their security, but what they are representing to their customers about the cloud and how secure their data is there?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of different ways of looking at that. I mean, if you look at it purely from a copyright issue, if we're going to stop and focus and try to examine what the copyright rights are in these photos, I don't know that it makes a whole lot of difference what Apple would do and the kind of representations it would make. But you know, there's just this, it's a real important issue, this privacy here. And it's something that has come up in conversation a few times this week. You know, there's this special meaning that we give to privacy when we're talking about it in this context, because there's privacy of what we think about in everyday life, of what things are private. And, you know, if I only share things, for example, in social media with a few users, I sort of think that as being private because it's not something that's available to anybody on the web at all. But that has a very different meaning when it comes to the legal context and what is there. So it's got to be mainly just a better sense on the individual user as to what kind of expectations of privacy to have. And I'm using that in the very general sense of using these services and what's going to be there. And I'm not so sure that we, you know, that any of this is too surprising to anybody. You know, it's scandalous, of course, that there were these celebrity photos that were accessed without authorization and later distributed. But really, I don't know that anybody is like so surprised. Like, oh my gosh, this could have never happened. We know inherently that these platforms have the risk of being accessed without authorization and content coming off of there. So it's just overall going to be, has to be a general mindset, you know, moving into, taking our collective mindset and moving it into a realization that that's just how things are these days.
You mentioned copyright, and I think there's an interesting spin on this story about, you know, we talked about monkey selfies recently on the show and not so recently on the show, and the issue of, you know, who owns the copyright in particular photos of a subject. And I could certainly see that issue coming up here as well. We often see copyright ride in what seems to be a privacy-related story when the privacy law doesn't seem to give a clear path toward a remedy, but copyright law might. As far as private civil actions go here, Evan, do you see anything happening along those lines?
Realistically, probably. Well, who knows? I don't know, because first of all, we're dealing with 4chan of here, users of 4chan, members of 4chan, participants in 4chan, whatever the most accurate way of talking about it is here. So probably sophisticated users. So I imagine there'll be a really hard time tracking down who is responsible for this. The indications are that it wasn't just one individual. It may have been a ring, and that these efforts have been going on for quite a while. I don't think the facts are really clear. I've seen descriptions of this looking like it was a brute force attack, you know, where they figured out the email addresses of these celebrities and then used automated means to figure out what the password was to the iCloud service, or if there was some other form of social engineering changing passwords. So I don't think we're really clear on all of that. But, you know, I guess we just got to see how it plays out. If we were able to identify the individuals involved here, I would think that it's likely that there could be a prosecution under this. The FBI has gotten involved in situations like this before, where celebrities have been targeted and their photos have been leaked online. And I guess there have actually been convictions, come to think of it. As far as civil liability goes, I mean, you could look at things like invasion of privacy, and we'd have occasion to look at that question of were these photos really private, the question I was sort of talking about earlier. And then, you know, things like intentional infliction of emotional distress. And then, of course, we sort of keep talking around the edges of all this, the copyright liability for having copied these photos from the service and reposting them, redistributing them on 4chan. And then they, you know, of course, got distributed further on Imgur, you know, through Reddit and other various other channels. So there's definitely the copyright owner in these photos, and that could be the celebrity herself having taken a selfie, or if to the extent it was somebody else taking the photo, that copyright holder there could have a civil cause of action for that. So there's a number of different ways civil liability could play out here.
Right, and the DMCA has come into it too already. There's a story, was dated September 3rd, at page 6 of the New York Post, that talks about a porn site that received a DMCA takedown notice on these photos and refused to take them down, challenged the notice because they wanted Jennifer Lawrence to provide evidence of who had the copyright to the photos. So you know, I'm not sure if we'll see that more than once, but it's kind of, we're used to seeing the DMCA protect the good actors out there and enable them to do business, but it can be, you know, used in any circumstance, and we're seeing it used here too. Art, I think this is just another step in the saga that goes back and forth between consumers and companies of how security is going to work for them. You know, Apple has had to back and fill a number of times and say, okay, you know, we've had something happen. We're going to implement stronger security measures. This is obviously a pain for users, but helps counteract this kind of attack. Do you think that this kind of cat and mouse is just going to continue?
Well, this is really the age old question in internet law, right? All of those causes of action that Evan was talking about are certainly relevant. And the underlying issue here is, of course, all those causes of action would apply likely to the individual or individuals that, you know, hacked the accounts and got the photos. But there's another question here, which is who else should be liable? And certainly in the public sphere and just in the media, Apple's taken a hit for what's been going on. But the technology here and the process actually is extremely important in terms of the causes of action and whether, okay, you know, blaming Apple in the public sphere is one thing. Are there any, you know, causes of action that could be brought against them? It's really important how this actually worked. And from everything I've read, it's not entirely clear exactly how the hack happened. Certainly, it seems that Apple was allowing infinite input of passwords, is what some of the reports are saying. And, you know, if that's the case, then that might have helped out sort of a brute force attack and made that easier. But it's two different things to say that an individual account was targeted and compromised by a really focused effort, whether that was brute force attack or phishing attack, versus the accusation that iCloud has been entirely compromised. And so I think, you know, it's still unclear exactly how the hack took place, but that's really relevant to the causes of action. And as far as some of the specific causes of action you all brought up, as the DMCA, definitely, we see that all the time. We work on both sides of that issue. Certainly work with a lot of people defending a lot of spurious, kind of ridiculous DMCA takedowns. But in this case, it's going to be, we have seen people, you know, who have real legitimate gripes. They don't like their photo appearing here and there. It's kind of inaccurately portrayed. But it becomes an issue. Ownership of that photo does really become an issue if you want to utilize copyright. And really, nobody but the copyright owner is supposed to be utilizing the DMCA to take things down. But there's nothing like the DMCA for takedown. It really, it's the only apparatus I know of in the law where you can just send a letter and the information is supposed to go down. It'd be really interesting. The site that you're talking about would be interesting if the folks who sent the letter, Jennifer and Lawrence's people, you know, would they, if they can actually prove ownership, would they maybe follow that up and see if they could go after them for some other form of liability? And then, yeah, it's a really interesting story about sort of expectations of privacy as far as the invasion of privacy issues. It's that basic question, you know, once you put something online, I mean, of course, we'd hope that our private photos would stay private if we're sharing them to the cloud, and more we are sharing more personal things to the cloud. But, you know, the internet is such that no matter whether it's just a simple comment on Facebook that you want to delete or you know, something that's even more innocuous, it's hard to permanently delete or to forever keep something private on the internet. And this is just another example of that.
Right. I mean, this is a good example of people who may, in the wake of this story and concerns raised by it, take an Admiral Adama approach, or Captain Adama, he was an admiral, wasn't he, to their connections online. You know, there's certain data that perhaps just should never touch the internet and or any sort of networked environment. And yeah, nude photos of oneself would seem to fall into that bucket. But you know, it's, I don't know if it's realistic in today's day and age to expect your run of the mill celebrity to take that into account. Terry, any thoughts on this?
Well, I think actually one of the more interesting angles is the 4chan angle at the moment. They recently registered as a DMCA agent within the past 2 days. And there have been, as you probably know, there have been a fair number of cases that say it's great that you've registered as a DMCA agent, but that isn't retroactive. So any behavior that occurred before, you're still on the hook for. So I think they could be looking at a fairly large copyright lawsuit in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one to, if you can just think about the amount of stuff that might be on 4chan, the ramifications of that are pretty staggering. All right, well,
you raise a really interesting point, which is that we actually work in a co-working space here in San Diego that is focused on Internet of Things. And it's really interesting mm-hmm. to think how the expectation of privacy might change as we all are constantly network connected through every device and everything that we're using in daily life. And it's kind of interesting to watch how that might change the expectation of privacy.
And it's also interesting to... it's interesting to examine this when we think of these two notions of privacy, one being what our expectation of privacy is just in the average everyday sense, and our expectation of privacy in the Fourth Amendment context, when we think about being subject to a warrant or a search by law enforcement or the NSA watching us or doing what have you here. Because with the ordinary, average, everyday sense of privacy, I think that's the analysis. That's the paradigm under which we would do the analysis for, say, for example, a tort claim for invasion of privacy. I don't think that it would be as easy to argue that you lose your privacy as easily when you post a photo, you know, just you have it in your iCloud, you store it in your iCloud account. I think it would be much more difficult in a civil case to say that you had somehow divested yourself of a privacy interest by doing that. It'd be much more difficult to say that than what it would say if it was the government that was searching the stuff in your iCloud account on your iCloud drive. The expectation of privacy that you would have in that context. Now, that's not to say that you wouldn't enjoy an expectation of privacy in your stuff that's stored on the server. I think that's still an open question, even though we've had cases even from the Supreme Court with the Riley decision, for example, that really does, it doesn't address it directly, but it certainly brings in the notion of Fourth Amendment privacy into the digital context in a way that's much more in line with what our ordinary thinking of privacy is all about. So I just think it's interesting to see how this the notion of privacy is malleable depending on what legal context we're bringing it up with in and how it would actually play out in the legal analysis.
Right, and I keep coming back to companies and what people reasonably expect when they are using certain services. And, you know, regardless of what the terms of service say, which of course are going to try and insulate the company as much as possible, you know, if you're using a strong password, if you're using two-factor authentication, then you probably have a strong expectation and a reasonable strong expectation that what you're storing in the cloud is going to be secure. And I just don't know, you know, how long courts are going to put up with companies hiding behind legalese that nobody reads in their 47 or however long Apple's terms of service are. They're staggeringly long pages of text that no one reads. And yet, you know, if there's still a vulnerability, despite all those steps being in place, I think that there's going to be a lack of patience on the part of lawmakers and law enforcers with that kind of approach.
Denise, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, because you bring up the question, how long are courts going to put up with this sort of Apple protecting itself through long and Byzantine terms of service? But the folks in IRC mm-hmm. were talking a few minutes ago about a really good point here. Would the public's reaction to this be different if this were Microsoft instead of Apple? Somebody in IRC, I wish I could give credit. It's already past the screen now, but now with Apple, it's just like, oh, hey, sorry about this, you know, YOLO. Pat on the back. And we're like, okay, it's all right. Maybe it's because there are other things going on in the world with NATO summits and ISIS and Ukraine and what was her name? I can't believe I'm spacing. The comedian who just died. Anyway. Joan Rivers. Yes. I mean, that's total mental block. Sorry about that. So, you know, we're so quick to forgive Apple in this. Would it be different if it was another company? What do you think, Denise?
I do think it would be slightly different. And I don't think, you know, too many folks are that quick to forgive Apple. You know, I think a lot of people have been pulled into the Apple ecosystem at this point, and they're going to expect that ecosystem to function in a way that meets their expectations. I know that was redundant, but you're going to have to take it. That's what I got.
Yeah.
The one thing I would add as an organization that does tend to spend a lot of time working with really, really bootstrap startups is it's a tough line to draw, and it's an important, you know, it's an important thing to protect consumer privacy. And we've worked with folks every day on that issue. At the same time, you know, you look at a company like Apple, and certainly it's easy to criticize their behavior. And I wonder, certainly folks need to be held to a high standard as far as data privacy, but to say, you know, there's held to some sort of absolute standard of keeping that data private. I think a lot of small companies do their best, and they know that to get customers and to keep them, they need to keep the data private. But what happens is they know that they can't promise they're 100% impervious, because they know technologically they're not capable of promising it. And so it's a real challenge as to where you draw that line for liability for that service.
Yeah, it sure is. And I think there's a whole lot of education to be done on the consumer side too. As far as the vulnerabilities in place here, you know, reading the coverage, Apple has denied up and down that it was the Find My iPhone service that had the vulnerability that you were discussing earlier, Art, that allowed the infinite number of brute force attacks, that somehow the data got out another way and they fixed that vulnerability. So, you know, I think as you point out, it's going to be important for any legal proceedings that go forward here to know exactly what happened. And then folks are going to be able to go from there. I also think this story is a good, aside from Admiral Adama, if you can't disconnect entirely from the internet or people don't want to, it's a signpost for services like Snapchat and others who are, you know, that their business model is to try and make things ephemeral, even if Snapchat is no longer quite the poster child for that, that it once was. As you say, you know, startups will jump into that void and try and offer a service that will allow people to share things and know that they're not going to come back to haunt them. But again, I don't know, you know, why you would have a database of naked photos of yourself stored in the cloud is beyond me. But then we've had federal judges who've had all kinds of interesting stuff stored. I guess it wasn't, I'm thinking of Judge Kaczynski and the terrible thing that happened with access to, it was his own server. It was not a cloud server, but it was a cloud connected server, and a lot of personal family stuff got out from that. So even very smart, very tech savvy people can have a challenge with this. I'm just, you know, it's sad for me that not just celebrities, but every consumer out there doesn't quite know what it might mean that they can, yes, share family photos easily and seamlessly with grandma and grandpa and far-flung cousins and anyone else from high school that they're keeping in touch with this way. But it might mean a whole lot of privacy heartache down the road too. Any final thoughts, Evan?
No, it's just that you wouldn't share these kind of photos with grandma and grandpa in the first
place. No.
That's all.
I don't know.
That's all. Just wanted to clarify that.
YOLO. Poor grandma and grandpa. They wouldn't know what hit them. All right. Let's, as long as we're talking about photos, let's talk about photos of a slightly different kind. One of our listeners, one of our audience members on Twitter pointed me toward a story that happened earlier this year that we never covered. And I think it's worth mentioning because it also involves photography and not really privacy, but the extent to which photos of you that are part of the data cloud around us all these days can be used to make your life miserable. In this case, there was an important decision from the California Supreme Court earlier this year. It was called People versus Goldsmith. And it was the end of 5 years of litigation over whether red light machines, you know, that decide whether you've blown through an intersection and deserve a ticket, whether the video that they take is admissible in court. And the argument made, and I think it was, you know, a fairly strong argument, is that they shouldn't be admissible unless they're very strongly authenticated, unless you have someone from the red light company, red light monitoring company, come in and, you know, describe how the data is gathered and maintained and why it's reliable, et cetera. The Supreme Court in California said, nope, that's asking too much. Photographs are silent witnesses. We've long held that to actual events. And so hearsay is not going to be a problem here and people can be prosecuted. These red light videos are appropriately admissible evidence. We're not going to throw them out. Evan, were you surprised at all about this decision?
Well, it's good to have the Supreme Court of California reviewing this, because I think it's a really important issue, not just in the context of red light cameras, but in any in the future that we will behold, where there will be so much more information generated through automated means, whether those be surveillance cameras or, as Art was underlining a while ago, the Internet of Things. There's going to be sources of data coming from all these disparate places, new sources of data that will come about and that could potentially have evidentiary value someday. So we got to remember what there seems to be two issues going on in this case here in front of the Supreme Court, whether this is hearsay and whether it's a violation of the constitutional right to confront the one who's testifying against you, your accuser here. And if we step way back and go back into the 18th century mindset of where these doctrines come from, you know, it's this idea of being able to really be certain that the evidence against you is accurate and to have the opportunity to cross-examine the adverse party against you in an effort to better get at the truth. So it's really important that we figure out how this happens. However, the Supreme Court of California is going to figure out how this happens, it's important that the issue be resolved. And you can kind of see both sides of it, because for one, from the perspective of the criminal defendant and the risk of being treated unfairly, we want to make sure that there's the opportunity to uncover whether the evidence was tampered with, whether the prosecution did something to it to make it more favorable and inculpatory before it was introduced into evidence. And, you know, that is usually ferreted out in the process of cross-examination. So that's why you have the video technician there who knows how the camera works and can testify that it was that the camera was working properly, and also to authenticate it to prove that it is what it purports to be. But then from another perspective of it, there's the part of that is missing when it's automated data collection sources, because, you know, cameras won't lie. Cameras don't have a motive to lie, or an automated sensor somewhere out there on the Internet of Things won't have the same incentive to lie as what a live human witness would, which is, and to get around that is why we have, or is one of the reasons why we have the rule against hearsay. So there's this interesting mix here. We have and at base, I guess it all goes down to this human element of the process by which a human has to bring this to court, on the part of the prosecution, to make sure that nothing bad is happening to the evidence, bad in the sense of it being made less accurate or not properly presented or in a way that's particularly biased or something like that. So it's not a real straightforward analysis because of the technological and automated automated nature of the way that the information is collected. And like I was saying earlier, the fact that these machines themselves don't do any lying or fabricating. So it'll be interesting to see how it turns out.
Yeah, picking up on one of your threads there, I would like to see, you know, I'm not a criminal lawyer, so I'm not sure exactly how this works when you're playing it out in court and you have a prosecutor, you know, you've challenged your ticket and a prosecutor's attempting to demonstrate, well, we have this evidence from the red light camera. If they are required to demonstrate that, you know, the camera functioned normally or from everything we can tell it functioned normally and it was not hacked. I'd want to know those two things were still being taken care of. Terry, this story reminded me of something that popped up in your Twitter feed this week, which was a tweet from Marek Sotag and a photo that he says is from the Czech Republic that is a please don't urinate in public kind of universal sign, you know, with the slash over the person doing the act, showing that if you do so, you're going to be recorded. And instead of threatening that you're going to be recorded and you might be prosecuted for something like this, the sign goes on to infer that you're going to be recorded and then you're going to show up on YouTube. So it's going to be, you know, it's even more, has more teeth than any prosecutor could ever throw at you in court, just the public embarrassment of it all. And you had an interesting take that, gee, you know, they're using the YouTube label logo there in that sign. I wonder if the Czech Republic got permission for that.
Yeah, I sincerely doubt they actually got permission. But the other interesting thing, so sometimes at New Media Rights, we help with a lot of takedowns, and we have a special category of takedowns that I've named, you know, 18-year-old boys doing stupid things. And those takedowns are usually rightful, since in YouTube's community guidelines, they pretty explicitly say you cannot post yourself doing illegal things on YouTube. So the idea of a state enforcement agency actually putting illegal things on YouTube as a method of public shaming is just so interesting for such a variety of reasons.
Oh, you know, I mean, the sign doesn't have any actual text. So you're interpreting it one way. You're thinking that the symbols depicted here mean we will put the video of you urinating in public on YouTube. I read it to just read somebody will. You know, everyone's walking around with their camera and you're going to show up on YouTube.
So. I didn't think about it that way. And admittedly, it would be very hard to actually enforce that unless you had a wide swath of cameras that were literally pointed everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think we do.
Who knows?
Telescreen.
Yes. I think that's about all I had on red light cameras and urination cameras. Let me just make sure. I do want to drop our first MCLE passphrase into the show. And that's going to be Teflon, hearkening back to Apple and how they come through the controversy that they're embroiled in this week. Oh, another thing, as long as we're on the front of crime and justice, another viewer, audience member, emailed me and said, hey, you know how I thought at one point, he reached out and said, I think this is a fake court order. Turns out it was. So he had encountered this before. Sundance Vacations, I guess, forged a court order. At least that's what they're being accused of here. Can you tell us more about this, Terry?
Sure. So Sundance Vacations is actually, they're kind of a known content bully in this space. They're really all about getting any possible negative review ever taken down from them, from the internet. And they've been trying to do this for a variety of ways. They've sent DMCA takedown notices, but those, for obvious reasons, weren't really working. So I guess at this point they decided, well, let's let's forge some court documents, because forging court documents is always a good idea. And that sentence never ends with anything ever bad happening ever. So I'm kind of surprised they went this far. But I mean, they just, if you actually look at it, it definitely looks off from even a layman's perspective.
Yeah.
I'm just absolutely shocked that they went this far to try to get their stuff taken down from the internet.
Yeah. Evan, if you're found guilty of having forged a court document, what are the sorts of ramifications you could expect to face?
Well, I'm pretty sure in Mississippi, they cut your hands off. it's where this purported court order comes from. So yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, anybody in IRC from Mississippi, but it's bad. It's a bad idea. You don't even need to really think about whether there might be a statute against this to know that this is just not good. And I mean, it's sort of like, you know, it's planted in your heart when you're born, the idea of not to do these kinds of things. And plus, I mean, there's the risk of actual legal liability for it. But, you know, moreover, there's just the fact that people are going to really recognize, you know, in very vivid terms that you're, you know, very disingenuous, or is that the right word? You're there's all kinds of words that you can use to describe how this just doesn't work. And this is just not, useful and effective ways of combating speech online. It's just not the way you should really go about the stuff. It can definitely backfire in a big way.
I don't know about the whole hand chopping off thing, but I think just about anywhere it would be at least a felony offense.
Well, so. We'll look it up. We'll see.
Yeah, forging court documents is not something you want to involve yourself in. Go ahead, Art.
And the whole story is just a reminder about how difficult it is to authenticate anything on the internet. I mean, there's the court order, there's the fake court order, but then there's, of course, this update that they did to the blog, right? On Wednesday, they updated it and were saying, well, apparently we might have received an email that was falsely identifying itself. And so it's just a reminder that it's very difficult to authenticate things, period, on the internet. And it's also a reminder that plaintiffs are going to find any way possible to try to remove things from the internet. And I remember years ago when I was helping launch a consumer website, I spoke to the people at ripoffreport.com, and that's one of those sites that has gone through these battles over and over through the years because they just don't take comments down. And so they've fought many of those takedown battles, and lawyers have tried every type of claim you could possibly think of to take content off of that site or disparaging comments about companies. And it's a reminder also, this thing's a reminder that for anybody who's running a website, when you get any kind of email or court order, to sort of pause, really take a close look at the order and hopefully even seek out an attorney. I mean, this is the kind of thing that New Media Rights does, provide services to folks who can't necessarily access them. So it's okay to pause and seek out assistance to understand what your responsibilities are as a website owner or as an app owner. So I think it's really important that people, you know, pause and take a look at what they're being sent and make sure that it's authenticated before taking that step of removing and taking content down.
Yeah, just because something is formatted as a legal document doesn't necessarily mean it is one. So it's something to pay attention to if you are a site operator, for sure. So now we've covered, we should put things into the cloud. Now we've also covered, we shouldn't believe anything that originates from the cloud. hopefully we have some more upbeat things in our future. And I'm not sure if people know this, but Art chairs the broadband working group at the FCC's Consumer Advisory Committee. So you know what we're going to talk about in just a minute here is net neutrality and the open internet rules and what is going on that front now that we've finally reached September 2014. But first, I want to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Personal Capital. Did you know that Personal Capital solves two barriers to growing your wealth? And who does not need to grow grow their wealth? I ask you. I think we all do. The first barrier is that it's hard to keep track of the kinds of things that you might have on hand. Maybe you have some stocks, a 401k, bank accounts, of course, investment accounts, hopefully, all on different sites and with different usernames and passwords. The second problem that you have is that you're paying someone to manage these things for you, and you just might be paying too much. Personal Capital brings all your accounts and assets together on a single screen on your computer, phone, or tablet with real-time and intuitive graphs. Personal Capital has an award-winning watch app that you can download in Google Play that seamlessly integrates with Personal Capital on other Android devices and provides users with relevant and timely updates on their finances whenever and wherever they need it. Personal Capital shows you how much you're overpaying in fees and how to reduce those fees. You also get tailored advice on optimizing your investment. So why wait? Signing up takes just a minute and it'll pay big dividends. Personal Capital gives you total clarity and transparency to make better investment decisions right away. And use a strong password, folks, when you sign up for your free account. Go to personalcapital.com/twill. Personal Capital is free and the smart way to grow your money. Thank you so much, Personal Capital, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's look at some issues, including net neutrality, on the legislation and policy front. All right, so the FCC got over, was it 1.4 million comments, Art, on, let's see, so the Sunlight Foundation has done a thing on 800,000 public comments, but I think they got more than, those are just the public comments. They got many comments that aren't public, so I think they topped over like 1.5 million comments.
I think it's the most commented proceeding ever at the FCC, is my understanding. There, I think it might have surpassed Janet Jackson eventually. But yeah, so it is obviously some folks are tuned in. And it was nice to see. I was looking at that Sunlight Foundation report, and they were talking about how only 60% of them were sort of automated messages sent in through automatic petition type systems, and that a lot of them were people writing in their own thoughts, whether it's just a couple, you know, a couple paragraphs or a couple sentences, or whether it was, you know, a 50-page comment, a 150-page comment. Yeah, there were a lot of people participating, which is really great to see, because it's a crossroads. We're definitely at a crossroads after the Verizon FCC decision, and this is a big moment for the FCC to decide whether or not we're going to do any kind of regulation over what has become the primary means of communication in the 21st century, and what is becoming, you know, even more so, the primary and eventually perhaps sole means of communication, and whether or not the body, the Federal Communications Commission, that's, you know, they're created to regulate communications, whether or not they will have any kind of authority to actually regulate communications in the 21st century is what this is all about. I should say that even though I co-chair the Broadband Working Group for the Consumer Advisory Committee at the FCC, that of course anything I'm saying is is corresponding to New Media Rights as opposed right. to the working group. We had an issue where some folks had written some op-eds, and there was some question about that. So I'm definitely speaking for New Media Rights and myself, not for the CAC.
Good to know. All right. So it's been a busy summer for you. And although we're talking about people synthesizing the comments, and the Sunlight Foundation has done a great post, and you can look at it and everything else we're talking about today. We've aggregated all the links for the show at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/274. The Sunlight Foundation took the 800,000 public comments that have come in to date and tried to make some conclusions about the comments in general, estimating that less than 1% of the comments were clearly opposed to net neutrality. At least 60% of them were form letters. But as you were saying, that means the volume weren't. At least 200 comments came from law firms, either on behalf of themselves or their clients. And they've done some cool graphics and things over there if you want to dive deeper into the data and try and, you know, read the tea leaves. And actually Sunlight Foundation answers the question I was asking earlier. Wait, where are the 1.1 million comments? And goes on to say that mailed comments postmarked prior to July 18th are still being scanned and entered per the FCC. So they've been so overwhelmed, they haven't even made all the comments available yet. And the comment period does not expire now until September 15th, extended from September 10th. So if you still feel you have something to weigh in on, add to the discussion, you still have about 10 days left to do it. So Art, busy summer, obviously coming to the close here on the comment period. What happens next?
So this it's the reply comment period now. That's September 15th is the deadline for that. Mm-hmm. The original comment period deadline was July 15th. So a lot of this particular phase is about looking at what folks have commented. And of course, that's very easy to do in the matter of 2 months with August sandwiched in there to look through all million comments and make some reply comments. I mean, the idea is to, gather comments and then to have people sort of, engage in a discussion. That's really, reply comments are where some of the points become very clear where there's disagreement. And that's what's really happened. Our comment, particularly for September 15th, which we're putting the finishing touches on, we're really focused on the independent creators that we represent, the internet users, and the kind of bootstrap startups that we work with. And we're focused on a lot of provider statements, broadband provider statements, that we think don't really have any basis and are fairly misleading. I mean, there's statements throughout, the broadband provider comments, that say there's plenty of competition in the broadband space. And, if we were to degrade or to cause any problems, right, the three main kind of tenets are transparency and then no blocking. And then these new open internet rules, instead of a no discrimination, that is, the old internet rules said you can't discriminate against lawful traffic, right? The new one just says you can't do anything that's commercially unreasonable, which is very unclear what that is. But the providers are saying, look, even if we did anything that would violate these net neutrality rules or the other, it's not a problem anyway because the market takes care of it. Well, a number of consumer groups, ourselves included, disagree with that. Some of the arguments, and really the most painful thing, and the thing that I'm also going to have a blog coming out on this subject as well, is the data that's relied upon by the broadband providers, frankly, is data that itself identifies itself as not being able to be used for competitive comparisons. And the example is providers rely on two things. They rely on the 2013 Internet Access Report from the FCC to say things like, well, 88% of people have two or more broadband providers. And the problem with that is that the FCC report itself says, hey, look, this is only based on kind of larger census tract data. And within those census tracts, there may be many people who don't have access to these providers. And so the truth is, we did some analysis of some areas here. And so we looked, and there's another bit of data that the providers rely on besides the Internet Access Report from the FCC, which actually says don't rely on it for competitive comparisons. And that's the national broadband map. And I don't know if anybody's ever looked at that, but it's pretty cool. You type in your address and supposedly it's supposed to kick back at you, hey, here are your wireline as well as your wireless broadband providers. And that sounds really, really great, except there are some serious problems with it. Most of the data we found just anecdotally in local areas here and for addresses here was inaccurate in at least one way and in sometimes multiple ways. One good example was we searched the entire database for a group called Platinum Equity. Platinum Equity is sort of a backbone small business provider. They don't provide to residential customers. But if you put in residential customers, it actually appears for 138 million of the 300 and something million addresses that are in the database. So fully a third or more of the addresses list Platinum Equity, when Platinum Equity is not a residential broadband provider. And so when broadband providers say there's competition, they're relying on various data that is either inaccurate or actually says that it can't be relied on for competitive comparisons. And so that's point number one where folks disagree, you know, is about whether there's competition. And, you know, whether there's competition is really critical. It has been in the past with regards to whether we regulate and how we stepped in regarding railroad monopolies and other early communications monopolies, right? Tim Wu's book, The Master Switch, is really helpful to kind of piece through some of those early monopolies. So that's a big question. That's an argument that's ongoing. And I found it telling that, you know, broadband providers theoretically might have the best data in that department. And if they could really prove competition, then it would be helpful to them. But the data they relied upon was just about the worst data. I mean, it literally says on the document, like, this is not for competitive comparison. So very strange that they didn't have stronger data there. And there's also the question of, you know, wireline providers say, well, hey, wireless providers like Comcast say, oh, hey, Verizon and wireless and AT&T and Sprint, those are all competitors to us. Those are all, we're competing directly with them. And in the marketplace, that's not really how it plays out, right? They're much more complementary systems that folks utilize. And so to say that wireless is directly competitive with wireline, I think is reaching as well. So the other big point of providers is the FCC decision, right? Said, hey, FCC, you can, the DC Circuit Court from January said, hey, FCC, you can go ahead and implement some kind of open internet rules, but it has to be done, but it would be under the Section 706 authority. Well, providers are happy to say that Section 706 authority, plenty of authority. The truth is that, you know, and that's another point of contention, right? And what we say and what a lot of other folks say, it sounds like the vast majority, according to the stats you're reading from Sunlight Foundation, are saying, mm-hmm. look, 706, the problem with 706 is it's such sort of paltry, weak authority that what's going to happen is every time the FCC decides to do any kind of enforcement, like one of the things that we had on tap today to discuss was T-Mobile's music freedom package, right? Mm-hmm. And whether or not you think that's commercially unreasonable, that's a good argument to have. But my point is the FCC can't even argue one way or the other or decide one way or the other without getting Title II authority, because this is exactly what will happen. Let's say the FCC decides to enforce under 706. The first challenge from the broadband providers will be, aha, actually, for this particular enforcement action, you don't have authority. Your 706 authority doesn't allow you to exercise authority over this. And so there will constantly be, until you actually get Title II, the internet, open internet rules, and reclassification of the internet under Title II, there will just simply be, you know, challenges based on the FCC's authority to regulate, rather than real discussion about what should an open internet look like? How should we, what are some of the rules that we should make? And let's make them carefully over the years. And it's not a, you know, providers are basically saying, look, there's a lot of sensationalistic talk from consumer groups and from individuals. But I didn't see that kind of sensationalistic talk. All I saw from people was look, there's going to be a gradual chipping away at what we've come to expect from the open internet. And there was an attempt by a lot of groups and a lot of individuals to say that we need to preserve the best things about the internet. And so, yeah, it's definitely after the reply comments, the FCC will take those and consider those. Some of their previous proceedings, because we were involved in the last open internet net neutrality proceeding, back in 2009 and 10. They also had a broadband legal framework, how to regulate broadband, which we were involved in. And it took a while for those to sort of be processed, that there were a far fewer comments in those proceedings. So it'll take some time. And then the FCC will have to decide what they're going to do, if they're just going to promulgate, you know, what's called the notice of public rulemaking, the thing that opened up this whole procedure. Mm-hmm. It does propose new rules. And that's what I was describing to you. The rules are pretty close. They look kind of close to the previous rules, but they're the devil's in the details, because the no discrimination rule became a not that you can only discriminate, or sorry, that you can't
commercially unreasonable.
Right. And so, and the definition, there's now been a definition of blocking that's been added as well. So I think it's going to be, it'll be a much bigger thing if the FCC decides, you know, that we really need reclassification. They can do it under precedent. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no reason they can't, they can reclassify, but right, that's going to be a whole nother, if they go down that path, it's going to be a whole new line that they're going to have to open up, probably a new proceeding.
Right. And I think, as you point out, probably litigation ahead, whichever way the FCC turns. If they decide to stick with this 706 and the, you know, thou shalt not do commercially unreasonable things, they're going to get challenged on that, and they're going to wind up in court, and they may have the Verizon situation happen all over again, where a court says you've exceeded your authority, FCC. And if they go ahead and reclassify at this juncture to Title II, there are going to be court challenges to that as well, won't there?
Yes, but I think they're two very different paths, because I believe there'd be litigation either way. And that's certainly what the broadband providers say. Oh, well, there certainly wouldn't be litigation if you put a 706 route. Not true. I mean, the only way there wouldn't be litigation is if the FCC just does nothing and doesn't do any mm-hmm. enforcement. Then the broadband providers would be happy and they probably wouldn't litigate. But if the mm-hmm. FCC decides to do anything, there'll be a lot of litigation. The problem is that litigation will only be about authority. It won't be about what are the correct interpretations of the rules. And so the second path, reclassifying, you might have to fight that battle, but I don't see how under the Brand X decision particularly that it can be argued that they wouldn't have the right to reclassify. There'll be all kinds of takings arguments and things like that, but I think there's been a lot of great responses to that already by folks. And I think that one could be disposed of. The second side of what you're describing could be disposed of rather, well, in the legal world, relatively quickly. But on the other side, I think we would just continue. We'd have another decade of continued authority challenges. And I think it hurts us. It hurts our economy. It hurts the broadband space in this country. You know,
would it necessarily be a decade if we got a couple of conflicting decisions in the courts of appeal? Maybe the Supreme Court would take this up sooner rather than later.
I mean, that would be the hope. But I think that, frankly, if they don't reclassify, I think the FCC will continue to lose. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. If they rely on 706, sure, it can go all the way up, even if it goes quickly, but they'll be told, no, you don't have authority. But they've already been told they don't really have much authority down that path. And the problem is that there's a misstatement by broadband providers that we have some sort of world-leading broadband here. And, you know, that's not fair to say, like in terms of mm-hmm. price, in terms of availability of speeds, and just in terms of availability, period, that's really not true. And so
I went to the broadband map and looked at broadband providers for my area, which I already knew without being told were extraordinarily limited. I have Time Warner Cable, which is my provider, Platinum Equity, which apparently is not available, and AT&T, which only delivers at 6 to 10 megabits per second. And those are the only wired options in the area.
Yeah, we found in when we were looking anecdotally that AT&T would mm-hmm. be listed, because they have some spots where they provide UVerse here, But in a lot of situations, there were whole apartment buildings, many, and there were whole rows of houses and things that all they really had, even though it said AT&T and that somebody somewhere in the census tract had U-verse, which was the higher fiber speed, right, which listed up to 25 on the map. They actually, many people in that census tract can only get 1.5 because it's DSL. And that's not even, you know, I don't consider that competitive. And the FCC, under their definition of broadband, the current one is like 3 megabits or 4 megabits down. That's not even broadband under the definition of the FCC's.
Fascinating. Well, let's look at the T-Mobile example. We've talked about that on a few episodes of the show. This is T-Mobile giving preferential treatment to music services in its, let's see, it's called Music Freedom. Why don't you describe first how it works, Art, so we know exactly what we're talking about, and then let's talk about how it might be treated as commercially reasonable or not.
Right. So T-Mobile is a competitor. They're competing with the big two, right? AT&T, Verizon have a huge portion of the wireless market. The other two providers trying to sort of compete are T-Mobile and Sprint. And T-Mobile is really, they've started this whole Un-carrier branding push. And so, I mean, but this is really at the heart of, I mean, they are certainly participating.
People probably don't remember the Un-cola.
Cola nuts. I remember that.
Un-cola nuts.
Is that 7-Up, right?
Mm. Yes, it is. You were
Pepsi
a wee babe, Evan. Yes.
Yeah, and I think I was in like grade school.
Yes.
But so what it is, the basic technology, as I understand it, essentially T-Mobile will just exempt certain music services, music streaming services from your data cap. So, you know, there were six that were exempted at the beginning, and then there were four others that recently got exempted. And so, okay, well, there's 10 or 11, maybe 12 that are part of the Music Freedom package. But
so these are not being delivered at any greater degree of speed or reliability. There's no fast lane being given to these services. They're just not counting in your data cap, correct?
Exactly. And so it's a calculation that consumers have to make. And I guess if a consumer really does push up against their data cap for those particular types of consumers, this may be a particular, put them over the hump in terms of making a choice. That last read I saw, for instance, that it was interesting because T-Mobile had invited a bunch of requests for services. And I guess they're trying to do a deal with Google Play Music later this year, but it's not necessarily added yet. Google Play, though, was the most requested service. And so for right now, I mean, it looks like Google Play might be added later in the year. But if it was, for instance, somebody deciding between Google Play and Spotify and they were kind of pushing up against their data cap, it might push the consumer one way or the other. And it's always, I think I'm always wary from my consumer advocate days of really, if the consumer is not making the choice based on the quality of the service, but based on the fact that their broadband carrier has sort of nudged that, you know, you should be using this one, this is the one that you should be using. That's one concern. But really the big concern is that this is an example of the gradual chipping away at net neutrality, because like you say, it's not the doomsday one. It's not what some people describe as the more difficult scenarios where services sort of pay for play and pay for quicker access and better access and this kind of thing. But it does raise a number of questions if you start to think about it. You know, what's to stop T-Mobile from using the data cap exemption as some kind of a penalty or against content providers that are trying to use broadband to reach their users, but they're not for some reason on good terms with T-Mobile, and for some other kind of reason that T-Mobile is trying to get an agreement or get some kind of terms out of those folks. You know, it might be able to be a tool to be used in other ways. These kind of data cap exemptions. And so it's kind of, this is exactly what you'd expect to see. It's sort of the first step along that path. And then it's kind of like the old frog in a pot kind of thing. Well, it'll change gradually. And then suddenly we realize, oh, now, wait a minute, why am I purchasing internet the way I purchase cable services? I know you've had guests on here before that have talked about, and it really is a question of, do you regulate ex ante, do you regulate before the fact or after the fact? And do you sort of just let things happen? And the thing about letting anything sort of happen is, over the years and seeing many cases, I've seen courts be very reticent to blow up, or to alter certain business models. So I think that's really the game plan here, is this sort of, whether it's tying up in the courts for another 2, 3, 5, 10 years, the idea is slowly introduce these business models. And then when folks challenge it later, companies are saying, wow, we've been doing this for 5 years. I don't understand why it's a problem now. So I think doing a baseline and then working from there and seeing, and having these arguments, what's nice to me is the FCC might decide this is not commercially unreasonable, but they can't really even have a discussion right now, as far as I'm concerned, under their regulatory authority. So why not give them the authority to, at least as a communications regulator, to at least consider whether it's okay or not.
So you're firmly in the FCC first and foremost, as you're ironing through all the 1.1 million comments, et cetera, you've got to plant yourself under Title II. You think that's their first order of business?
That's where I finally, I've arrived there because I just don't. What pushed me, the Verizon FCC decision puts you there. I just don't, it necessitates it.
Well, Evan, let's assume for a second that the FCC goes forward without taking that big step and decides that it would be a political hot potato and not something they're willing to tackle at this point. And they enact the proposed rules that have been garnering all these comments over the summer. And they're asked to decide whether this, what do we call it again? Music Freedom Initiative from T-Mobile is commercially reasonable or commercially unreasonable. What's your take on the way that will go?
I have no idea. I mean, I would ask Art what's going to be in the mind of the of all the different parties and the stakeholders here and how it would actually play out. But what I think is most interesting about it is that look at what a pro-consumer thing this appears to be. So with something like the music freedom and the availability of all this stuff, especially if there's going to be a wide offering of different services here that don't go against the monthly data cap, where's the outrage going to be? I mean, is there really going to be that much to be upset about? Are people really going to get so fired up about this? And is the World Wide Web going to go dark for a day in response to something like this? I just have no idea. I would ask Art.
What do you think, Art?
That's a really good point about the way that these things are sold. That's exactly the idea, right? Is you start with something that. And everything is couched. If there was one word that everyone tried to claim, right, in the comments, it's that they were actually interested in the consumer. They were more interested in more holding the consumer's interest than anybody else. And you're right that that's actually what's most disturbing about this, is that it does all the things I was talking about, but it also couches itself as, the consumer friendly option. So, that'll be what's argued, but I really think that it should be up to somebody else besides the company to decide whether that's actually true for the consumer, for the larger marketplace, for the kind of competition and startups that are trying to bring other products to the consumer. That shouldn't be in the hands of the incumbents and the incumbent broadband providers to decide.
Okay, well, I think we're just about due for a second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If I didn't mention it earlier, we put these passphrases into the show so that if you are engaged in asking for continuing legal or other professional credit for listening to this show, there are various, the legal professions, one of them, professions where you need to stay up on certain things. And we like to think that we're a good way to stay up on the latest and greatest developments in technology, law that affects technology. So our second passphrase for this show, so that you can demonstrate that you actually watched and listened, should you need to, is toilets. And the reason that it's toilets is that someone who opposes net neutrality has decided that toilets make a, as Mashable says, a catchy case for net neutrality. Maybe we could play a bit of that video, Victor, when you get the chance. I know I didn't ask you to cue it up, but when it makes sense to do so, let's see, you know, if we can get some toilets flushing. The message of the video is, of course, that you're flushing. Here we go.
FCC, don't take away our net neutrality. The internet was made for you and me. We need it for communication. The YouTube and the Facebook Nation.
Okay, I think that's
for
about
sharing
enough,
selfies night and day.
Says everything's better with a toilet, right? At least it sticks in your brain when you add toilets. I did have a good place to move from here. Go ahead, Art.
Oh, I wanted to just say one thing. It's really cute. My favorite was probably the net neutrality rap that came up a while back on Twitter. So if you haven't seen the net neutrality rap, that's also a good one. And certainly John Oliver's net neutrality segment was amazing. But I just want to make it clear, I love that video, but it's interesting the language that's used, because you talk about taking away net neutrality, and just I would love to remind folks that technically we're asking the FCC to step in and to restore net neutrality, because frankly, after the FCC Verizon decision in January, it doesn't really exist. You know, the rules don't necessarily exist. So it's just something to remember about what specifically that we're asking at the FCC.
And you know, right. the metaphor sort of missed me as well, because, you know, I'm all about creativity, and it must have been fun to get together with friends and strangers alike and sit on toilets for a few days in downtown Manhattan, you know, with a stop motion photograph. But the metaphor misses me, because the biggest implication I got from it is that the average everyday user just generates a lot of crap, you know, so it's not really worth having open internet to distribute in the first place. But anyway, I go.
Well, here's where I was going to go, is that the average everyday user now has the internet as perhaps a recourse for a career and livelihood in a way that they never did. And whether it's a lot of crap or not, there are certainly a lot of people out there who are using sites like YouTube and others to pay the bills and keep the lights on. I just found right before the show, because yesterday I was driving my son and his friend home from school, and they're giggling together in the back of the car, sharing videos with each other. And they were watching videos by a guy named Ryan Higa. I'm not going to say his name that he uses for his YouTube channel, because it's potentially offensive, but there's a Forbes article that I put in our discussion points, so you can read about. It's not all about Ryan Higa. It's mostly about other entrepreneurs. The title is Three Entrepreneurs Who Changed Their Lives with YouTube. And the focus of the article is, hey, you know, there are people out there that are really funny. Ali Spagnola, who we've had on the show a bunch of times, falls into this category. Hysterically funny, hysterically talented, wildly talented. And, you know, they are able to use these channels to go directly to an audience and actually make money and have a livelihood, and you know, in a way that's never been possible before. But
could I put a plug in there, actually?
Yeah.
Ali and myself and another video and filmmaker, viral video creator, Cy Kuchenbacher, and then another YouTuber, Tay Allen. We all have a panel proposed at South by Southwest Interactive called You Just Went Viral, Now What? And this is the last day of voting. So if anybody wants to give us some support, please feel free to do so.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for mentioning that. I'm going to plug a bunch of potential South by Southwest panels at the end of the show that people should be paying attention to, but definitely pay attention to that one. So in this age where, you know, YouTube and others, but I think, you know, I think we just go ahead and say YouTube seems to be the ground zero for people who are engaged in trying to reach a wide audience with their toilet video or otherwise, that they and you guys have been paying attention to this issue. YouTube has its own issues to confront about the all important views of your video or page views, however many people have watched and taken advantage of the fact that you've put your content, whether it's worthy of being flushed or not, online, that YouTube is now having to deal with the fact that, you know, I mean, they've dealt with this in search for years and years now, and are now having a species of gaming and manipulation of numbers with video views as well. Terry, I'm sorry, we haven't heard from you in a while. I'm going to go ahead and wake you up and have you talk to us about YouTube bots and new media rights involvement.
So YouTube bots are actually quite an old issue. This problem started back in 2009, or at least that's when I could find the earliest news story about it. But because YouTube bases its search procedure, it's basically its entire system on how many views a video gets, they have a term in their terms of service that basically says you're not allowed to use bots to increase your views. Mm-hmm. And this is a pretty common standard term that you'll see in a lot of terms of service. However, the interesting thing on YouTube is how they handle it. So I actually, we handled this case once before my time, actually, at New Media Rights with a band called Fortress of Attitude and their song P.S. Gay Car, which was flagged for bots when Forbes and HuffPo and a variety of other sites picked it up. And as you can imagine, when you go viral, when you are picked up by a number of large news entities, somehow your number of views tends to go up. And this was misflagged in the system as buying bots. Well, we weren't actually able to come to a resolution to that till very, very recently, when the video just sort of magically popped up with all its views a year and 4 months after our last appeal. Or, sorry, 4 months after our last appeal. But this once again came to the forefront. We got a huge swath of takedowns that users weren't getting notice about why their video was being taken down. And they also didn't have an appeals option. So we reached out to YouTube about this. And it's like, hey, this is weird. And when we reached out, they're like, oh, yeah, this is a bot's takedown. The user got notice. And we tried to work with YouTube and because bots is it's a really huge problem on YouTube, not only from YouTube's end, but for the average consumer, an entrepreneur online. For example, let's say you're a YouTube entrepreneur and someone doesn't like your content. Well, they can flag you, they can send DMCA takedown notices, I should explicitly say, I'm not recommending anyone do this ever, but it's actually quite easy to get a video removed maliciously through bots. You can use sites like Fiverr and a variety of other websites and very simple computer programs that will basically spam YouTube on one particular video. And that's a very good way to have a video taken down. The other part of this that the real reason why we got involved is that there is an appeals process. As we detail in our blog, The Curious Case of the YouTube Bots, it's not one of YouTube's better forms. It's not really written for the average user. But the bigger problem we were noticing is that we were involved at the time that story was written in about a dozen cases. None of the appeals worked. None of them. Even when we sat down with the person and we wrote it out, like a lawyer would write it, like we imagined the team would at Google would expect to see it. And we just noticed this trend that none of the videos were going back up. So we're really concerned that, you know, we understand why YouTube needs to take things down for bots, but giving users no method to appeal when there is evidence that people have used bots as a way of maliciously taking down videos is highly problematic, especially for a lot of our users and entrepreneurs, because they're building businesses. They're investing a ton of money into these YouTube-based businesses. And the heartbreaking reality, and this has become the thing that I have to tell people over and over and over again every time we get contacted, is here's the appeals form, but the reality is YouTube as a private website, as long as they stay within the bounds of the law, can kind of take down whatever content they want at any time, which is understandable to a lawyer, but to the average person, they don't see YouTube as a private company. They see it as a platform. They see it as a public park. They see it as a public sidewalk, somewhere that they're entitled to be, somewhere that they can, somewhere that really is a free and open space for speech. And it just isn't. It's not a free space for speech. It's not an open space for business or even young performers so that they can rely on it and know that their videos won't be taken down for wrongly, for no apparent reason, for going viral and getting accidentally flagged within YouTube's system. So it's a huge problem we're seeing online. And it's when you take a step back for a moment, it really is part of the much larger problem of speech online. And since there is no public park, there is no public space for free speech online. It's all run by private companies. So how the First Amendment exists online and who's regulating speech has become this really interesting question. And we're seeing this a lot with Twitter now at the moment, too, with what they decide to take down in various cases of harassment, what they decide to leave up. So it's very problematic that we've left all of these private entities in charge of regulating speech online. And well, you know, I think a lot of the, you know, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Twitters of the world, they're really trying to regulate speech in a way that's fair, but you know, they're not the government. They're not really set up, and they have honestly very little economic incentive to regulate speech in a way that's, we would normally consider under the First Amendment as free speech. They really don't have a huge incentive there. So it's a hugely, hugely problematic area within internet law. And it really hasn't been addressed, I think, largely because there's no clear legal way to address it.
No. And if you tried to let the government put out a site that was going to be a competitor to YouTube, I think, you know, healthcare.gov comes to mind. And I just don't think, you know, there are some areas in which private entities in our free market economy are going to go out and be able to outdo anything the government could possibly approach. So yeah, it's an interesting conundrum. Can I back up for a second to the bot question? And dig a little deeper on something you were saying. Were you suggesting that perhaps a rights holder, or maybe not a rights holder, that doesn't have a clear path to a DMCA takedown of a video, but somebody objected to a video for other reasons? So the DMCA wasn't going to be a clear or safe way for them to get it taken down, but they want it down. So you're saying that what they might do is unleash a bunch of bots, which would then lead YouTube to believe that the person who had posted the video was trying to game their system and up views, and the video would come down?
Yes, and we've seen that case before. I can't really talk about it any more than we've seen a case exactly like that, where the appeal was unsuccessful, even when given very, very, very specific information. So It's not a question of if, it's already being done.
Wow.
It is already a very effective tool to get something taken down from the internet without having to go through Content ID or the DMCA process, for which there are very few legal consequences. I mean, the only legal consequence could be if that person also had a YouTube account, and if YouTube somehow traced the bots back to them, and then they could terminate all their Google accounts, but which could be very traumatic for a lot of people that use Google, but the odds of that actually happening are so minuscule that, yeah, it's essentially a very easy way to get things taken down off the internet that you don't like with almost no consequences.
It's interesting to think if it's if these are two commercial enterprises, and I guess ostensibly they are two different parties going onto YouTube to engage in commerce, make money and monetize that content in whatever way you can. It'd be interesting to think if there would be a civil cause of action against the one doing the bots for some form of unfair competition, you know, that body of the law sort of nebulous, and you come up with something like that, you know, doing something, it's like a tortious interference, maybe something like that. So it'd be interesting to,
unfair business practices.
Yeah. At least academic, theoretically, to talk about that stuff, but who knows how it ever panned out actually.
Right. Well, before we get to our tips and resources here, I'm hoping Art and Terry can bring us up to speed on more of the great media rights has been involved in over the summer. You guys did a really cool thing with 1,000 legal matters. Can you bring us up to speed on that? What did that involve?
Sure. So this summer, we're celebrating our 1,000th legal matter that we've assisted on since we started. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's we're probably closer to even closer to 1,150 now. I mean, we run a very, very active intake form that is a place where we both find folks that we end up working with as clients, but also a place where we're able to point folks in the right direction, help them understand some of the basics about the laws that they're interacting with every day. And that's what makes us really, really unique. So we thought we'd take a breath and celebrate. And so we had an event here in San Diego, and we had a celebration on our website. There's a lot of posts on our Twitter account, for instance, of testimonials. And there's all these cards that sort of describe the stories of the people that we've helped. That's everybody from speakers. You all were just talking about bots takedowns, right? Which are sort of these difficult community guidelines areas on YouTube. You know, the original one that we worked with quite a bit was Anita Sarkeesian with her takedowns. And so there was, we have a testimonial from her, but we also have testimonials from groups of open source game developers like the Dark Mod, who took their game mod and made it an independent game. And we helped them actually understand the copyright issues when doing that. But, you know, it ranges everything from defending remix creators' right to speak to helping, nonprofits do what they're trying to do. There's a story about MapLight on there, which is this awesome San Francisco-based nonprofit that connects votes of legislators with actual donations to legislators. And they do some really, really interesting data work connecting those two things. And so it's been a time for us to celebrate the 1,000+ legal matters we've already helped out on. And we're just preparing for the next 1,000. And so, it's been a chance. We had a big celebration here in San Diego, and we did it San Diego style. We had a taco guy and aguas frescas out there. So it was very good.
That's awesome. That's so great to hear. And congratulations on 1,000+ matters. You guys do great work. One of the other things you've been doing this summer is getting involved in all of the meetings around the country on the copyright green paper. I know we talked about this the last time you both were on, but bring us up to speed on both what that is and the meetings that have been happening.
So that process has been ongoing so far. Just to give those who aren't familiar with it, the USPTO and the Department of Commerce launched this green paper over a year ago at this point, asking for comments on how copyright should be changed or modified in the digital age. And one of the things that came out of this comment period was a variety of not only roundtables, but also this DMCA working group. And we've actually been a part of both, at least the Los Angeles Roundtable, and I'm on the DMCA working group. And there are a couple different things going on. The roundtables have been very targeted on a few specific issues. All of the roundtables have covered digital first sale doctrine, statutory damages, and Remix and copyright law, and the general direction we need to go. The interesting thing about the way the roundtables are going is there's definitely a shift towards trying to find non-legislative solutions to copyright, seeing if there's a way that we can develop industry best practices that really serve as a way to, while we're waiting for the next great copyright act, should it ever come into being, with the many, many, many copyright policy proceedings that are going on, that this could serve as some sort of intermediate step. The roundtables have, and I was at the LA one, and it was certainly lively. I would say the Remix panel in particular was one of the more lively policy panels that I've been on.
I'm sure.
But there's also this DMCA working group that's a much smaller group made up of artists, folks from both the tech and content owner side, as well as some folks like us on the NGO side of things, representing consumers, that are working towards DMCA efficiency. And it's really, and we're actually going to have another meeting of the working group that's open to the public next Wednesday starting at 10 a.m. Eastern time, to go over some of the findings. And what the DMCA working group has been working on lately is sort of a guide to creating your DMCA takedown notice and takedown form, which is really interesting, since there are statutory guidelines, but we're looking at is this better? Is there a way to make it more friendly for both the large content holders and also for sites like YouTube and other small sites that maybe work with smaller content holders who might see the statutory language and not have any idea what it actually means. So it's definitely an interesting process. Allegedly, at least on the non-DMCA side, the USPTO and Department of Commerce should be putting out a paper end of the year, maybe early next year, on the findings and potentially presenting some interesting solutions going forward. And I just more of a pitch to any of your listeners, whether they're lawyers, academics, interested parties, this is a public hearing. Regardless of your affiliation, you are more than welcome to not only attend meetings, but also speak at some of the meetings and roundtables. So please, if this is an area you're interested in, please, please, please get involved. Honestly, the future of digital copyright is too important to leave up to chance. So that's why we've been involved, is really ensuring that the future of copyright is friendly to both consumers, small internet companies, and also to those smaller artists who don't have a team of lawyers to enforce their copyrights.
Yes. And for anyone interested in getting involved and being heard on these issues, there's a whole list of the 2014 public meetings. We'll again put it in our discussion points at Delicious. But if you just Google Internet Policy Task Force and Green Paper, you're going to come up with this page, I would imagine. It's interesting to me, Terry, that it's the USPTO and the Department of Commerce. Why is the Copyright Office not in the mix here?
So that took me a while to figure out, but apparently the USPTO serves as the advisor to the president on primarily international copyright matters. So when it comes to negotiating treaties like WIPO, they're the ones at the table and listening and bringing things back. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're involved, because the president is interested in the future of digital copyright. But it's actually funny because both Congress and the Copyright Office have their own independent proceedings that have also been going on over a variety of different issues. So I know for a smaller organization like us, we've really had to pick our battles as to where we actually have time to get involved, since there have been so many calls for comment. I feel like the Copyright Office is putting one out every couple of months.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of copyright reform going on.
We're very fortunate to have your ear, since you're actively involved in these discussions, and I'll just put in my plea. And I know it's just kind of, if you can aim for the bleachers, why not do it? And this is that kind of plea for some kind of clarity, since they're thinking of policy issues and how to improve the way business is conducted and how to improve people's use of digital media. And you were just on the Remix panel, I'm sure this must have been a central piece of the discussion, some kind of clarity on fair use. Because for lawyers such as Evan and I who get clients coming to us, and I'm sure, you know, same thing with the clients that you handle at New Media Rights, with specific problems where, you know, here's what we have in mind. We'd like to do this. And, you know, can we do it? And, you know, oftentimes fair use is a pathway to being able to do it. But to be able to advise a client that they have any kind of legal certainty if they go down that path is virtually impossible. So any way to take fair use from being quite so amorphous into something where if you jump through these certain hoops, you're going to be in good shape would be a good thing, don't you think?
Well, maybe. We have been in talks, and I do think that fair use could use some clarity. I think there's a couple of dangers there with making it too clear. I think it's always important to remember that there's a camp that doesn't believe in fair use at all, doesn't believe it should exist, doesn't believe it currently exists, despite it being in the statute, which is something I've never quite gotten my head around. But on the less extreme side, we have seen countries make changes to fair use in an attempt to make it easier. For example, Canada has actually introduced this multi-tier fair use where it's like, oh, if you're non-commercial and fit into these categories like educational use or journalism, then your use is going to be fair use. But I believe they also run through a factor test. So there have been some attempts, but no one's really come up with a model for making it simple. The USPTO did definitely bring up the idea of a federal best practices for all fair use. But as I'm sure you found with your clients, fair use is so different for every genre that you're looking at, every type of media, that it's really hard to come up with one overarching guideline that fits everything that really actually works at some practical level. So that's one thing that they're looking at, but it would be nice to have some clarification towards fair use. But I just haven't seen a model that's made it simpler. I know in many parts of South America, they actually have a system that's in civil countries where it's, if you fit into one of these categories, no matter what, it's fair use and done. Mm-hmm. Boom. But it's a very inflexible way of handling fair use. Because any innovative approach is pretty much, well, it's too innovative, our law doesn't handle it, it's not fair use. And I really don't want to get to a world where that's the case. As much as we think things like educational use and journalism are straightforward, I think they're a lot less straightforward than we think.
Yep, that's an excellent point. Well, something for them to continue to discuss, I hope. Let's move on to our tips and resources of the week. We have many for you this week. I'm going to run through them fairly quickly. Number one is at New Media Rights site. There is a great guide if you are someone who is concerned about not running afoul of the FTC's disclosure guidelines. This is, it's entitled Disastrous Disclaimers in the Digital Era, a how-to guide on correctly implementing disclaimers in the age of digital media. We're not talking about disclaimers such as I have no liability kind of disclaimers. We're talking about disclaimers letting people know if you are sponsored or engaged in advertising. So great guidelines there for you. For folks who are engaged in that kind of speech online. A couple of other tips, things not to miss. One is an event we've got both coasts covered here. One is an event on September 19th in New York. It's called Code the Deal. It is sponsored by the New York Legal Hackers and the law firm of Nixon Peabody. It's basically the New York
Legal
Hackers.
That's where everyone's a winner, right?
Yes, that's right. Evan, you remembered. Everyone's a winner at Nixon Peabody. Yes. Anywho, great event. If you're in New York, I would check it out. It's about the transactional side of technology dealings. So definitely get to that if you're in New York. And if you're not, if you're over in San Francisco, we're talking about the USPTO. If you would like to meet with the chief of staff of the USPTO, Andrew Burns, you'd have the opportunity to do that next week, Wednesday, September 10th, at the law firm of Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe at noon Pacific time. They're doing From Silicon Valley to Washington, D.C., Insights from the Intersection of Technology, Law, and Politics. So a great opportunity if you're in the Bay Area and would like to hear what the USPTO chief of staff has to say. I guess it's the one-year anniversary of his holding that position, so hence the event. And then our resource of the week for you is if you're looking for things that you can use without worrying about fair use, wonderful endeavor by someone with an unpronounceable name who I'm going to pull up and try and pronounce here real quick. Caleb Lietaru is what I'm going with, has been engaged in, he's taken as a model sort of the digitization that's gone on with Google Book Search and decided, you know, there are a lot of images in books and there are tons of images in books that are freely available at the Internet Archive, but they're not readily searchable. So he has taken it upon himself to upload just, let's see, how many millions? 2.6 million pictures from the Internet Archive to a Flickr account with tags so that they are searchable. The name of that account is Internet Archive Images. So wonderful resource for finding imagery from the year 1500 until 1922, all of which has been stored at the Internet Archive but hasn't been terribly easy to find until now. Now it's searchable on Flickr. So really cool resource there. And as Art pointed out, it is the very last day to vote on panels that might be happening at South by Southwest in March. So some you should pay attention to if you're fans of this show. One of them is from Legal Hackers in New York. Warren Allen's been on our show before. And their panel is on Legal Hackers, a global movement to reform the law. So look at that one. There are also panels on free speech and fair use. Etsy's Sarah Feingold is on that one, in addition to other great speakers. A panel with the Sunlight Foundation on open government, and another panel on student data and privacy, which, again, a very important issue as more and more information is gathered about all of us and all of our kids. So definitely weigh in on those. Evan, one of these years we're going to make it to South by Southwest. We always say that. Maybe this will be the one. 2015 in Austin. I don't know. No, I never
managed to make it.
We've got time to plan.
We just might make it. Yeah.
We might. Anyway, this has been just such a fun show. Great information, Art and Terry, so fun to have you join us. Anything you want to leave us with as we're going out here? Art, I'll start with you.
I just put a plug for a brand new guide that we've got out there available to people. It's a guide to intellectual property issues and fiscal sponsorship. So if anybody in the audience knows of or is involved in a project that is sort of a scientific research archival project, right? We just saw an archival project there that needs to understand intellectual property issues and the important considerations that happen when you become part of a larger organization as a fiscally sponsored program. We have a guide that's really focused, and it's on our front page there, actually. We have a guide that we just launched yesterday, and it's really designed to help those small projects understand how to work with larger entities and work within the structure of a larger 501c3. So I'd say go ahead and check that out and share it with various scientific and archival and research projects that you might know who might need that help. But thanks for having us on. I appreciate it.
It's been really fun. Terry, anything you want to add to that?
Since we are actually a fiscally sponsored program of California Western Law, but we're not actually funded by California Western. We always like to put a pitch out if anyone is interested in supporting our work. We're an extremely small nonprofit working on a shoestring budget. And we're always happy for both monetary support and just getting our name out there, since we found that through referrals from our community, we've found some of our most interesting clients and interesting experiences as an organization.
Very cool. Thanks so much, Cherry, for joining us. Evan, so fun to chat with you again.
I had a great time, too. It was lots of fun, really interesting things to talk about today. Seems like we covered a lot of different things, didn't we? We got all the way from copyright to net neutrality to privacy. So,
but no dubstep. There's always that for next week.
No, we save that. That'll be good, and I'm sure that won't go away soon. If you've got people upset about that story, so it's something to look forward to. So, yeah, great time. Enjoyed it. Good
yes,
to see you.
Thank you as always for joining me here on This Week in Law. I mentioned that you can see the links to all the things we've discussed and plugged and mentioned at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/274. You can watch this show live when we record on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. But if you can't join us live, you can find us at twit.tv/twill. We're This Week in Law on YouTube. We're on iTunes. We're on Roku. Various other ways that netcasts are distributed. You're going to find us there. And we're just thrilled that you can join us however and whenever you can, whether it's driving down the road at 65 miles an hour. I'm not quite sure. One of our listeners pulls that off a lot. And I'm not quite sure how he does it. But, you would not think that we hit the truck driver demographic, but we do. Because these issues are important to everyone who uses technology and puts any kind of data anywhere. So we're really glad that you join us and that you let us know what's on your mind and what kinds of issues are of grave concern to you or are funny and entertaining as well along these lines. So get in touch with us and let us know what you're thinking. I'm Dee Howell on Twitter. Evan is Internet Cases there. You should check out Evan's blog regularly because he puts great stuff up there. He's at internetcases.com. And you should also go to our Facebook and Google Plus pages because they're a good place for you to expound at more length as to what you have in mind, any responses to stories that we've talked about, follow-ups, information, leads. Also, you can email us. I'm denise@twit.tv. Evan is evan@twit.tv. And gosh, I can't believe we're already into September. We will see you for the next episode of This Week in Law next Friday at this time. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care.